All right, welcome back to Whence Came You, a Freemasonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. I'm your host, Brother Robert Johnson. This is episode 184. In the news this week, I did want to mention that on the Masonic Roundtable, we did have a York Rite episode. It was a lot of fun. If you caught the video somewhere in the last third of the show, I think Nick Johnson and I are both showing off our Templar swords that we had. Even Brother Juan Sepulveda brought out the very Templar sword he used in the first design of the Masonic Roundtable artwork that we used on Facebook. It was somewhat funny of a moment. I guess you'd have to be there. Well, the good news is you can be there. So go check out the YouTube video for that episode, the York Rite 101. Just a pin update. Many of you have been ordering the button pins. Those are shipping all the time. Once a week, I gather a bunch of them and I ship them out. So if it's been a couple days and you don't know what's going on, just trust that I am getting them out to you. If you don't receive it and you bought one and it's been, say, 3 weeks or something like that, shoot me an email. By all means, don't feel that I'll think you're being pushy or anything. If I didn't get you the pin, then let me get you the pin. So in addition to that, we are going to be moving forward with brass pins that we ran before, and before they were made in the United Kingdom, and the entire production was done there. The new pins are being done by Symbol Arts. They will be brass. Like I said, the enamel is going to be slightly different. It's not going to be a raised kind of bubble finish on it. It's going to be more of a flat, really kind of a modern lapel pin. It is going to be fantastic. We're going to sell those the same cost. We're going to do $10 on those. We were going to do a pre-sale, but instead of a pre-sale, I think we're just going to go ahead and order them and we'll ship them out as we sell them. We'll pay the manufacturer back and support the show at the same time with the remaining part of that donation. In addition to the pins, there's going to be a couple other things. We might do some cufflinks. We might do some tie bars. We might do one other thing also, and that one's a surprise, so we'll save it for later. That one, the extras, the cufflinks and tie bars and the special piece, will be extremely limited. Those will be only 25 of each of those being made. The lapel pins will be limited also. It will be another good run of those, but there shouldn't be a huge shortage as we had last time when we only had 23 lapel pins. So if you got the WCY lapel pin the first time around, there was only 24 available. Two of them immediately went out to two brothers in Pennsylvania. Another one went out to a brother in Pennsylvania. I kept two for myself. So that means that there were only 19 lapel pins of that one that were ever made. So super limited. So if you have one, hold on to it. I hope it'll mean a lot to you. So those will be coming again, like I said. Follow the Facebook feed for that, and we'll get the news out about it as soon as it becomes available. I did want to go over two small campaigns that are going on right now. We have a brother who listens to this show. His name is Brother Dean Jones. And if you're listening, brother, you've done a fantastic job with these. He has created 3D mini busts artwork, and right now he's looking to produce them. And he's running a Kickstarter campaign to produce these. They're digitally sculpted, and so he's looking to crowdfund these. If it's a success, he has promised me. Now, I'm hoping he comes through on this also, and I know he will. Some Masonic busts like Albert Pike in the future. So if this sounds cool to you, these first run are from The Wizard of Oz. It's Oz Friends mini busts, and it looks like he's got Scarecrow, the Lion, and the Tin Man, and they're pretty darn cool. So if you have a minute and you want to help him out, and if this becomes a success, then he can go along and start making these Masonic ones also. I'd love to see what these things go for. How cool would it be to have a little mini bust of Albert Pike on your desk? Pretty cool stuff. The Kickstarter campaign is kickstarter.com/82469754/oz-friends-mini-busts. It's a super long address, so rather than have to remember that or write it down, just follow the link. It will be in the extras under links, and if it's on the blog page, you'll see it there too in the show notes. So check those out. Let's see if we can get him funded and move through these cool ones, and we can see some cool Masonic ones in the future. So our thanks to Brother Dean Jones for contacting us with this. I really hope this becomes a success for you. He's been a great friend of the show in the past, and I just hope you guys listening will help support him in this endeavor. The other thing is a very, very cool thing that a lodge in Michigan is doing. Brother John Kogeschel, I apologize if I butchered your last name, but in any case, he wrote me a few weeks ago because his lodge in Birmingham, It's Birmingham number 44. They're hosting their second annual charity auction and Freemasons Gala on April 18th. So not too far away, just next month. And he is taking this on, a large portion of the responsibility of setting this thing up. And so last year, they raised thousands of dollars for the Shriners Hospital Fund, Michigan Masonic Youth Fund, the Knights Templar Eye Foundation, and the Angels of Hope Fund. And they were also very fortunate enough to be able to help several children with special needs right in their own community directly. And they've done tremendous things with this fundraiser. If the auction, what it needs are things to auction off. So products, services, unique access stuff, as he puts it, which would be like sporting event tickets or unique experiences, maybe skydiving or something like that. Unique items like crafts, or perhaps, you know, I make those little matchbook lodges. I would totally make a few of those and send them out. So if you have something to contribute to this auction, please go to www.birmingham44.com/charity/donate. Again, links to that will be in the app under the extras. Also, if you're on the blog page, you will just see it there in the show notes. In addition, if you just want to go ahead and donate, I'm sure you can do that too if you just want to do some cash. But let's help out Birmingham 44 and let's get them some cool things that they can auction off and really make this a giant success, even more so than the previous years. John Kogashel is one of the donators to the show who has given quite a bit. It's only right that we give back, right? He gives us so that we can continue bringing this education to everybody. So let's help him out and let's help that lodge meet their goals. So we'll go right into the paper of the week. The first, this paper is from the Illinois Lodge of Research, as last week's was. It's called A Closer Look at the Great Temple of Solomon and the Legend of Shamir. All right, so in this paper, if you hear a little bit of paper rustling again, it's because I'm reading it off of paper. I will scan these and add them to the app extras so that if you enjoy this paper, you'll be able to do whatever you like with it in the PDF form. A Closer Look at the Great Temple of Solomon and the Legend of the Shamir by Dr. Stephen R. Greenberg. From the beginning of mankind's history, men have been engaged in temple construction. The Temple of King Solomon, erected in the 10th century BC in fulfillment of a divine command, did possess a singular form, though that edifice was not the first structure of its proportion to appear in the Near East. King Solomon, in attempting to establish his nation in cultural equality with his neighbors, borrowed heavily from them. According to Professor G. Ernest Wright of London, Solomon's temple had a resemblance to a Phoenician structure, characteristically observed in the nearby country. In more recent times, at Tanat in the kingdom of Syria, a building of like magnificence was unearthed, which appeared quite similar to Solomon's temple. This Syrian structure possessed three chambers consisting of a porch, a grand hall, and a sacred inner chamber. On either side of the doorway leading into the main hall were placed round pillars, the bases of which had survived the ravages of time. From this discovery, a structural relationship to Solomon's temple in Canaan was established. Additional archaeological evidence has shown much Solomonic influence in several areas of Judea, notably at the stables of Megiddo. Among the ruins of long-forgotten ancient cities are buried the remains of great temples in Egypt, Nineveh, and Babylon. None, however, appear to have surpassed the great temple of King Solomon in either recorded endeavor or magnitude. King Solomon initiated the erection of a temple 3,000 years ago that was destined to achieve immortality. The temple's foundation was firmly implanted on a rugged mountaintop, Mount Moriah, the place where Abraham was instructed to sacrifice his son Isaac. Here also, King Solomon would receive the responsibility originally given by God first to Solomon's father, King David, a charge to create an edifice of great beauty and magnificence. This edifice was to be, for all time, a place fitting to manifest the divine presence among the chosen people, a building dedicated to the worship of the one true and living God of Israel. Obviously, then, the location was select to impact upon the history of the Hebrew nation. The great wealth flowing into King Solomon's coffers allowed the acquirement of the most skilled and ingenious craftsmen from the neighboring regions of Greece, Phoenicia, and Syria. To their number were added the workmen of Egypt, including 80,000 hewers in the mountains and 70,000 bearers of burden. Overseeing these craftsmen was 3,300 masters of the work. The timbers, cedars, and fir employed in the temple building were felled and prepared in the forests of Lebanon under a treaty secured from King Hiram. Additionally, Hiram agreed to furnish the 80,000 workmen who were hewers in the mountains. For this commitment, Hiram received the King Solomon an annual payment of 20,000 measures of wheat, 20 measures of pure oil, and a consideration of 20 cities. Recent evidence suggests that the biblical prohibition concerning the use of iron implements applied only to the actual construction of the building. Because the temples erected near the Near East during these early centuries by the Phoenicians and Syrians revealed the use of both iron and copper in their construction, it is now believed that iron-edged tools were utilized in the forests of Lebanon to fell hard wood. The actual construction of the temple in Jerusalem, however, was performed devoid of the sound of axe, hammer, or any tool of iron. This was in conformance to the ancient Hebrew custom related to iron taboo. Concerning construction of the temple as a repository of the Ark of the Covenant, the scriptural accounts of these activities is referenced in the books of Kings and Chronicles. To commence the construction of the temple, the site atop Mount Moriah had to be leveled and a foundation set up both deep and strong. The foundation and the walls were constructed from great blocks of limestone quarried with effort and skill from the thick stone beds underlying the city of Jerusalem. This fine, porous limestone, soft in its natural state, soon hardened upon exposure to air. The stones were hewn, squared, and numbered in the quarries for prearranged positions for the foundation. The material for the massive walls rose to a height of approximately 150 feet and extended across 36 acres. The general ground plan was made in the form of three squares, referred to as the Temple Court, the King's Court, and the New Court. Additionally, the building maintained a massive proportion within its main square that contained its most sacred place. That structure was 165 feet square with gates at the four points of the compass. The temple building proper occupied the west area of the square, facing toward the east, ready to receive the rays of the rising sun. This structure measured 100 feet by 70 feet. On its front face was a porch in the form of a square tower rising upward three stories to a height of 144 feet. On the first floor was a porch, the entrance to which was through a gate of brass. Further, at the entrance to the porch, on either side of the doorway stood pillars of brass, 27 feet high and 6 feet in circumference. The one on the south, right hand, was called denoting establishment. The other, on the north, the left hand, was called denoting strength. It is believed that King Solomon, in erecting these pillars, had reference to the biblical pillars of cloud and fire that went before the Israelites in their journey through the wilderness. In his representation, Solomon viewed these pillars as memorials of God's promise of support for his people of Israel. References here were from 1 Kings 7:21, 2 Chronicles 3:17. The pillars were adorned with chapters upon which were adorned networks containing two rows of pomegranates. Beyond the pillars and porch was situated the most holy place, a room measuring 24 feet by 48 feet, an apartment none but the priests were permitted to enter. The last room measured 24 feet square and contained the sacred Ark of the Covenant with the overlying cherubim and the mercy seat. The original Ark of the Covenant built by Moses was manufactured of acacia wood. It was 27 inches in length and 16.2 inches in width. The Holy of Holies was separated from the sanctuary by doors of olive wood covered by fine linen and veils of blue, purple, and scarlet. Exodus 36 31-32. Only the high priest was permitted to enter here, and then but once a year. The ark contained a copy of the tablets of the law received by Moses from God on Mount Sinai, together with the pot of manna and Aaron's rod, the symbols of Israel's deliverance from the cruel bondage of Egyptian slavery. On each side of this holy place were chambers of three stories each, covered by a gable roof set on the right angle in imitation of the form of the tabernacle tent. On the east side of the temple court was located an area called the Great Square of the King's Court. In its center was placed the brazen scaffold, about 6 feet square, from which King Solomon offered prayers at the dedication of the Great Temple. On the separate sides of this area were structures large enough to house the many wives of the king. Another group of structures was designed as a private place for Solomon and his queen. The second floor was designated as the quote-unquote middle chamber, access to which was gained by a flight of winding steps. This room was set aside for the use of King Solomon to conduct his private devotions. It was in this chamber that some of the most holy scenes of Hebrew history transpired. In the courtyard surrounding the temple, stood the great sacrificial altar of brass, 30 feet square and 15 feet in height. Nearby stood a great basin called the Molten Sea, which was 15 feet in diameter and capable of holding 2,000 gallons of water. The building, when completed, fitted together so perfectly that it had more the appearance of one entire stone. Its roof of olive wood was overlaid with gold. The various courts and apartments is estimated could accommodate 300,000 people. As King Solomon's holy plan progressed, his ideas expanded to a scale much grander than that of the original tabernacle described in Mosaic law. When completed, after almost a quarter century, a grand collection of magnificent buildings and statuary had spread across 36 acres. No edifice, before or since the era of Solomon, can compare with the magnificence. The noted British architect James Ferguson relates, quote, "The temple at Jerusalem, the lower court stands on its magnificent terraces, the inner court raised on its platform in the center of the temple itself, rising out of the group, and crowning the whole must have formed, when combined with the beauty of the situation, one of the most splendid architectural combinations in the ancient world," end quote. King Solomon's temple remained intact for a period of 420 years. However, despite its magnificence and holy purpose, the temple fell victim to years of neglect by the priests charged with its care. The end came in 599 BC, when a great Chaldean army led by King Nebuchadnezzar invaded Jerusalem, overran the country, and destroyed the Holy Temple. As a result of this invasion, the Chaldean invaders seized the treasures of King Solomon and enslaved the Hebrews for transport to Babylon. Though treated well, they desired to return to their homeland. This request was granted by King Cyrus in 520 BC. The Hebrews, led by Zerubbabel, returned to Palestine to rebuild a second temple. After nearly 500 years, Herod's Roman legions destroyed the second endeavor. A third temple was later erected by Herod, which stood for almost a century before being leveled by Titus's Roman army. In the saga of biblical history is the inference that despite the many cycles of disaster spanning three centuries of recorded time, the foundations of Solomon's temple laid deep and strong, of immense proportions by countless hosts of ancient craftsmen, has remained unmoved and unchallenged. Allegorically, so is it with Freemasonry. Its foundation, composed of the greatest principles given by God to man, remains unmoved amid the onslaught of time. The opposition of evil men may injure our institution. Our noble craft may be vilified from without and by unworthy conduct from within. Lodges and temples may perish, but for all time to come, our Masonic foundations are strong and deeply set in righteousness. Standeth sure, having this sealing the Lord knoweth them that are his. References: Horn, Alex, King Solomon's Temple in the Masonic Tradition, John Bunyan, Solomon's Temple Spiritualized, Charles A. King, Solomon's Temple, Michigan, Coldwater, 4th edition. Roldak Baxter's, The Architectural Style of King Solomon's Temple. Frank Trumper, Some Notes on the Building of King Solomon's Temple. And Thomas Day Cranston, The Two Great Pillars. All right, so very quickly, I would like to just mention the ways to support this show. We have three apps for your mobile devices, whether you're on Android, Apple, or Windows Phone. Check those out. They allow you to stream the show and have access to the bonus features, which are weekly Masonic wallpapers for your mobile device, and access to the papers that we read on the show via PDF. In addition to this, if you like to do some shopping, you can shop at onnit.com for some healthy living supplements and workout equipment, freemasonryart.com. Either one of those two, you can use coupon code WCY and you'll get 10% off, and they'll send a little bit back to the show to help keep the lights on. And our newest sponsor is very cool, freemasontees.com. They've got some great t-shirt designs coming out. There's a lot of people that are doing this. However, I do believe in freemasontees.com. Brother Jeff, who runs this site, is doing a lot of work to make it cool. He's got original designs. They're pretty unique. My favorite one is the Illinois Freemason one. He has a couple like this. I'm actually buying my Illinois Freemason shirt from him this evening. So if you get a shot, please go over to freemasontees.com, use the coupon code WCY, and you'll get 10% off. And I believe he sends about 10% back to the show also. It's a very generous gift, and we really appreciate it, brother. And last but not least is our PayPal donation. So you can just directly donate a dollar or two, which would tremendously help us out. And I really, really appreciate it. What your donations do is it's not just to keep the show alive, but in the long run, you are basically a producer of the show. You are somebody who is bringing this show to everybody else. And we really do appreciate it. And at that, we will go right into this week's Esoteric Freemason Minute.
Welcome back to the Esoteric Freemason Minute with your host, Brother Matt. Recorded again from the Secretary's desk at my home lodge, Dundee Lodge number 190 in Carpentersville, Illinois. My topic today may be controversial to some, which is unfortunate because it is an obvious truth that everyone knows to be true, whether or not they consciously realize it. Just like life does not end at earthly death, life does not begin at earthly birth. We did not come from the earth, we came to the earth. This is one of the first things that Masonry teaches us, yet unfortunately very few realize it. At the beginning of the Entered Apprentice Catechism, we are asked, "Whence came you?" and are expected to give the reply, "From a lodge of the Saints John of Jerusalem." Where did we come from? We came from another realm. We came from a lodge of the initiates of the Holy City. The word Jerusalem in Hebrew ends with the word Shalom, which means peace, but also indicates a wholeness or completeness or fullness. There is a place called the fullness that the Gnostics rightly claim that our deeper, truer selves came from, a realm of light where we lived lives before coming down here to earth. We used to live there and had houses and jobs and families. There are both roads and royalty in the Pleroma. Life down here is an imitation and shadow of life up there. The term for this place is the Pleroma, which is a Greek term used in the New Testament for the fullness. Those of us who descended from the Pleroma to take on flesh will ascend back home once we break free from these chains of the cycles of reincarnation and achieve the ascension or the apotheosis or the resurrection here and now in our own flesh. Once we reach the state of enlightenment and we are filled with the fullness of God, we will have access to all the realms of the heavens and will be able to travel to this pleromic realm of light at will whenever you desire. The return home is the path of apotheosis or the manifestation of the Christ within. Your personal star of Tifereth resides up in the Pleroma, and so a part of you is already connected to our home. The deepest part of the Christ within resides in the realm of the Pleroma, and when we begin to live in and through that internal Christ, we begin to bleed through the upper realms into the lower. We begin to manifest heaven onto earth. We are raised to a vibration that uplifts everything else around us as well. Our quest back home to the Pleroma is not only available to us after we die, it is something that we must achieve here and now. It is the aim of true spirituality, to return to our former glorified estate and to be reintegrated with our higher selves that reside in the higher realms. This requires an awareness of higher realities and unseen vibrations to help you tune into the core of yourself that is beyond the static of the clutter of distracting thoughts and the blinds of the flesh self. We were once in a state of fullness. We once resided complete and whole. We were beings of light, innocent in the garden, but then we came down and took on meat bags and skins of flesh. The parable that Jesus tells about the prodigal son refers to this truth of the descent into flesh. We have brothers back home who never took on material flesh, but we, who left our father's house, wasted our inheritance, ate with the swine of the earth, and then returned home to beg forgiveness, are welcomed with open arms by our Father in heaven. In fact, the son who leaves home and eats with swine is celebrated more than the one who stayed at home and didn't experience the confines of an earthly body. The Gospel of John also tells us that no one can ascend into heaven except he who has descended, and this descent into flesh is a prerequisite for apotheosis. No one can return back home in a more celebrated and glorified state except he who has a home to return to. This devolution of man is mentioned in the answer to the first question in the EA's proficiency examination, which teaches us that we came from a lodge or state of wholeness or fullness. Descent into this realm of brokenness helps refine and prepare us for the administration of the powers we will wield after material death and spiritual exaltation. This life we live now is only to help prepare us and challenge us. We came here to build and to be refined. We came here to learn and to subdue our passions and to improve ourselves in Masonic principles. That is why we need to reincarnate a few times, because we children of the heavenly Israel are stubborn and need a few lifetimes to learn our lessons. After death, we go to a sort of spirit world where we experience the energies that we harbored in this life in a more potent form, and we continue on in this realm of Sheol until we earn the right to reincarnate again. Some people come back to Earth immediately, and some come back after 20 years. It depends on a variety of factors, including the judgment of the overseers. In my last incarnation, I was a Mason during the 1970s, but was a rough Ashlar with a thorn in his side, and so I needed to come back for another round to perfect my Ashlar. However, in this lifetime, I plan on presenting work that will pass inspection and entitle me to the wages and refreshments of the afterlife. We are the eternal thing that comes and goes. Our true selves are immortal, and these garments of skin that we are trapped in are not who we really are. They distort our perception and they weave illusions, such as the absurd idea that what can be seen with the physical eyes and measured with physical instruments is all that there is in the universe. We will never die, for death and the grave are not the end of mankind. We were born into the bosom of eternity and then descended and took on these temporary vehicles until the time of our redemption from the bondage and restrictions of these physical cages. We are infinite. We are infinity trapped with infinity, and we must awaken to where we come from and where we are going if we want that properly expanded perception of life that lays out our path for us and clearly displays the summit of human knowledge, which is our duty to God and to man. When you begin to truly realize that you are immortal and that material reality is a temporary illusion, then material possessions and bodily passions and physical comfort become less of a slave master over you, and you can learn to control that which has been controlling you. Compassion and love for the destitute becomes an obvious duty when you realize that your fancy suits and their dirty rags cover two different brothers from the same cosmic mother. If there is one thing that I want you to get from this episode, it is that your life did not begin at your birth, and that your life will not end at your death. You are eternal and immortal. What did we come here to do? To learn, and to subdue our passions, and to improve ourselves in masonry. These three things help us learn how to properly administer the divine forces flowing through us. Learning is the refinement of reason and intellect, which helps mediate and curb passions, as well as train us in handling the divine reason, the higher logos. An untrained mind cannot be a proper vessel for the indwelling logos, and if you manifest the logos without properly arranged channels of neurons, you are in danger of mishandling that divine force and abusing it for your own personal desires, which is an action that will get you punished and your powers revoked. Learning to subdue our passions is an extremely important lesson because we are slaves to our passions if we do not master them. It is dangerous for someone with demons of the flesh to wield higher energies. Their lust or greed or pride will defile the body and soul and the world around them. Emanuel Swedenborg wrote about a man who he saw get kicked out of one of the higher realms of the afterlife because he could not control his lust for beautiful women in that realm of potent, manifesting energies. You came to this earth to learn to control your passions, so make sure that you do your job, or who knows how many more times you'll have to come back before you do it right. The third reason that our catechism states we came to this material realm is to improve ourselves in masonry, which is to subconsciously implant and fully operate through Masonic principles. The obvious moral lessons that we are taught in ritual and lectures are necessary to the perfecting of our soul. We need to actually observe the precepts we memorize. It is not enough to know what to do, we actually have to do it. Take time regularly to review the Masonic lessons taught in your Blue Book, and make an assessment of how you are doing. Masonry teaches simple yet vitally important moral lessons that we need to implement if we want to become a true builder. We are training on Earth to become literal operative masons, but with cosmic energies instead of physical building materials. Make these three items your daily goal. Eagerly seek to learn, humbly desire to subdue your passions, and honestly apply Masonic principles to improve yourself in masonry. Earlier, I mentioned that the term, a lodge of the Saints John of Jerusalem, means a lodge of the initiates of the Pleroma, and I would like to briefly clarify why I equate the term, John, with the word initiate. One of the mystic secrets of the ages is the mystery of the Saints John. What I'm about to say is a truth known only by some, yet is vitally important if you want to understand true biblical symbolism. The term John means an initiate, and those of us who walk the path of light are given this symbolic name, just like Masons are given the symbolic name of Hiram. We are Johns, and normally all the members in the lodge are Johns. The Gospel of John is probably the most important and esoteric book in the entire Bible, and I encourage you to attempt to look at it through different eyes on your next read-through. First off, the esoteric interpretation of the Gospel of John, and not the other Gospels, is that John the Baptist and Jesus Christ inhabited the same body, two riders on the same horse. When John was beheaded, that symbolized the death of his flesh so that the indwelling Messiah could reign in the body. We are all Johns who prepare the way inside of us for the manifesting Logos, the indwelling Word, the Christ inside. John represented the purified lower self. Jesus represented that divine self that descended. This John-Jesus secret only works on the allegorical level of the Gospel of John, but historically there were two separate people named Jesus and John, but the details of the Bible were altered to fit certain patterns. Another secret of interpreting the Gospel of John is also given to us in the first degree. The author of the Gospel of John knew about the symbol of the circle within the perpendicular lines, and it was encoded into the structure of the book. The two lines represent the two saints John, and if you look carefully at the Gospel of John, you'll see that John the Baptist only appears in the beginning portion, and John the Evangelist only appears in the ending portion. The circle with a dot in it is an ancient symbol representing the sun, the gold, and the Logos. In between the section on John the Baptist and the section on John the Evangelist, we are told the allegory of the incarnating personified Logos. That symbol helps bring a deeper interpretation to this book, which is included in the Bible given to most new Masons. You come from a lodge of the initiates of the Pleroma, but you also go to the lodge of the Saints John of Jerusalem, for I am John and you are John. Certain secret orders, including some of which that had a degree of influence on Freemasonry, have, over time, had the Hierophant, or top-level initiate, take on the name of John, or often the French Jean, when they take office. Leonardo da Vinci took on this symbolic name, and it is apparent from his art portfolio that Leonardo was obsessed with Saint John the Baptist. I will close off this section with the wise words of John the Baptist, who said, "I must decrease so that he may increase." The lower aspects of ourselves need to fade away and decrease, and the divine aspects of ourselves need to increase in volume. There is another important teaching contained at the beginning of the Entered Apprentice degree and at the end of the Master Mason degree. This is the concept of heavenly masonry, or of a lodge that exists beyond earth. Masonry, in its purest form, did not evolve from stonecutters or ancient mystery schools. The true origin of masonry is not on this planet, and so we need to stop limiting some of the interpretations of symbolism to what we can find in historical records. The square and the compass is used in Pleromic masonry, as well as many other familiar symbols. Masonry and Masonic symbolism on Earth is only a shadow of the Lodge of Light. This is an important factor in mystic masonry that I do not have the time to get into now. So, in conclusion, whence came you? From the realm of light. What came you here to do? To refine and improve myself in order to be worthy of inheriting that which is to come. In the coming weeks, reflect more on where you came from and where you are going. Look for how this applies to practical applications in your life. Not everyone living on Earth right now comes from this realm of light. There are those who branch off of another vine, but they are not who I am speaking to, and very few of them would be listening to this. If you've felt alien in your cage of flesh ever since you were a kid, be assured that you are one of us, and that we will all be reunited. Most of the children of light gravitate to the mystery schools, and, in the West, those schools are primarily Masonic ones or Masonry itself. That young punk that you don't understand in your lodge may have been a Mason in his past life and is just returning to our fraternity to complete what he started. Many of the older generations of Masons are Pleromic beings as well, even if they don't have the same awareness of their home that children of this generation do have. We come from the realm of light, and we'll return to the realm of light. Seek to break off all of the superfluous parts of you that waste or squander the light you hold. That's all for now, and if you have any comments or questions, feel free to email me at efm.matt@wcypodcast.com. Be blessed with the light of the Logos and the wisdom of Sophia.
All right, links to everything mentioned there will be in the show notes. And the next thing I wanted to do is, I know it's been a little while since we've done two papers in one show. This isn't necessarily a paper, but it is a rather short poem that I did enjoy, and it's called "Someday I'll Be a Mason." So without further ado, here it is. "Someday I'll Be a Mason" by Walter K. Belt, reprinted by permission of the Philalethes. You say I am a Mason now, since I have taken every vow, but you are wrong, my brothers. You've given me a book to turn, and I have lessons yet to learn, from this great light and others. But if I love my fellow man, and live by heeding God's great plan, and let his judgments chasten, with guidance from the printed page, from lodge past masters, old and sage, someday, I'll be a Mason. All right, that was just a quick little poem, and I thought it was pretty apt, and it was right there in the Illinois Freemason, right after that other article. I'm sure some people will enjoy it, so I hope you did. We'll go right into this week's famous Freemason, Vannevar Bush, born 1890, passed away 1974. He was an American engineer, scientist, and developer of the first electronic analog computer. So we've all seen those old cartoons or those old movies where they bring out these huge computers that didn't have as much power as we have in a TI-82 graphing calculator today. Well, this is one of the guys that was one of the first electronic developers of this thing. He is perhaps best remembered as the author of the revolutionary essay As We May Think, published in 1945, which envisioned much of the technology we take for granted today, including personal computers, the internet, hypertext, online encyclopedias, and speech recognition software. In 1939, Bush, a worshipful master in Massachusetts' Richard C. McLaurin Lodge, was appointed president of the Carnegie Institution of Washington. As such, he assumed considerable influence over the U.S. government in military and scientific research. Bush was involved in the development and proposed use of the atomic bomb, even, and as the alleged head of the Majestic 12, quote-unquote, the purported codename for a secret committee of scientists, leaders, and officials formed by President Harry Truman. And Bush is rumored to have investigated UFO activity in the wake of the Roswell incident as well, which was the supposed crash of an alien aircraft in New Mexico, 1947. The secrets his fellow lodge members may have heard are almost too immense to contemplate. So I think that was a great famous Freemason, super interesting. We could talk for hours about it. Maybe we will. But that's it for this week. I just want to thank you for all your time. Thanks for listening. I really appreciate all the feedback we're getting about the Esoteric Freemason Minute, about the Freemason Minute with Brother Steve Harrison. Just great stuff. I can't be more excited about it. And keep on coming back week after week. I just can't thank you guys enough. So please find us on Facebook. Like us on there, and you can find us on Twitter as well under Wince Kamu. You can find us on Google Plus at the email address wcypodcast@gmail.com, which is also an email that you can reach me if you need to get a hold of me for any reason. In addition to that, you can reach me at admin@wcypodcast.com. And again, please visit our sponsors, and until next week, stay on the level. For Wince Kamu, I'm Robert Johnson.
People say you've had your day. I'm a man that will go far.